The Shortcode Podcast is a proud member of the MedEd Media Network. Inspiration, information, and guidance on your journey to medical school and beyond at mededmedia.com.
Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues, and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcode.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcode Podcast. I'm Dave Etler, and if I sound different, because I've been taking voice lessons.
You do sound different.
I thought it'd be good for my podcasting career if I sounded like an 11-pack-a-day smoker. Just feel like... things are going to take off now.
You know, the other way to do that is just to smoke 11 packs a day.
Well, it's cheaper this way.
That's true.
Here with me today are some of the titans of medical education. Say hi to Casey McCleary.
Hey.
John Pienta.
Hello.
Corbin Weaver.
Hi there.
And Matt Wilson.
Hey.
Before we start into the meat and gristle of this week's show.
Wait, you don't want to get into the gristle, though.
Yeah. Hey, man. I'm not going to judge if you want to get into gristle. I want to ask our listeners to please leave us a review on iTunes. In fact, I challenged our listeners a couple weeks ago to leave us just 10 new reviews during the month of March. And despite my forgetting to mention it in last week's show and then accidentally posting that show at double speed. Sorry about that. We're well on our way.
It's a true medical school mistake there.
Well, you know, the person who wrote me an email to say, by the way, I don't know if you realize this.
It's not an accident. Get used to it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he thought maybe we were just trying to show him how med school is done, but yeah, we're well on our way. Thank you to let's see, Ferdavs Saeed, Amara Spall, and Triple Cherry 001 for your kind words. It really helps us to know that you like what we're doing. So go ahead and give us some reviews.
We need the validation.
Yeah, I mean,
it's true.
External validation. It's helpful. Guys, we heard from some listeners this week, some other listeners this week. First of all, our first question is Julian. Julian is kind of pissed. Let's hear what he has to say about the admissions process.
I'm a longtime listener and want to start off by saying how much I look forward to each new episode every week. It has really helped me get through the stressful last 10 months that have been my second application cycle. On to my rant that is tinged by a stinging post-interview rejection from my top choice today. Mm. At each of the 6 interviews I attended this year, some form of the following statement was made. This is just as much about you, the applicant, finding out if we are a good fit for you, as it is us picking you. Bull, I say. Over the last 3 years, 48.7%. 47.9% and 47.7% of applicants have only been accepted by one school, which invalidates that statement for half of matriculants. Med schools know they hold compete control, and that applicants will ask how high if they say jump. I'm curious of your guests' impressions of the application process.
What do you guys think about this? I mean, there's two things going on here. Number one, I mean, rejection sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're applying to medical school, you're competing with a whole bunch, unfortunately competing with a whole bunch of other people who are trying to get into the same medical school. I think here it's like, we interview like a million people. That's not really true, but
it's like 600 or 700.
1 bajillion people.
Well, we interview 700 people.
They're all from California.
150.
to 400 are from California.
They're all better than you.
Yeah. 150 will get accepted, but you know, there's people applying, like 4,000 people apply or whatever. I don't know the exact numbers, but
golly, I always forget that those numbers are so high. That makes me feel special.
Yeah,
but you also have to think about
way to rub it in, by the
fact
sorry.
That each person applying to medical school is putting out like, you know, 10, 15, mm-hmm. 30 yeah. applications, you know.
That's true.
Also, it's really different from someone from Iowa, an in-state resident of Iowa, or even any Midwest schools. We're not, like, hurting for medical schools around here, but
yeah,
we were
like,
joking
there's
earlier.
There's only 2 in the state of Iowa.
Well, I mean, but when you think about, for instance, like, Washington, there is one med school for, you know, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, Alaska.
Mm. Oregon.
or there's another med school in Oregon.
There is one. Oh, that's true. I thought OHSU, you could get into, I thought you could still get into the Seattle one.
No, it's not included in the WAMI.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
But for instance, we're joking about how many Californians there are. There are so many Californians population-wise. Like, that is a huge state. And if you have all of these people trying to apply to med school, it just makes it more competitive. So it's a little different, I feel like, for Midwesterners.
Yeah, and he didn't say where he was from, too, but...
Yeah, that's, probably California.
Probably.
Yeah, they have 14 medical schools in the state of California, I think, mm-hmm. something like that.
Not even
but I would imagine the population, like, proportionally is way bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things I think about that too, the language in there is like, I think they try to sugarcoat it or something, you know, that's my guess, best guess as to why they use terminology like that in it.
Yeah. Well, they don't want you to feel bad about not getting in, you're saying?
Yeah. My impression is that that's a little more true for like the match when you're going, is that, do you think that's true, John? That you're more... trying to impress the schools are trying to impress you as much as you're trying
you have
to
a little bit
them.
More power, I think.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what to think about that. However, I will read you my email from the National Registry Resident Matching Program on Monday.
Well, before we do this, as we record this, it is match day, the day when people find out where they're going. Most people find out where they're going to do their residency. So earlier this week, people got notified yes or no that they matched. That was Monday. And then today they find out exactly where they're going.
So mine says, we are sorry you did not match to any position. That's it. It's in bold. Ooh. It's in bold.
Oh, it's in bold.
Oh my God.
So you know that they really are sorry.
Oh my God. Wow.
So, you know, two different strategies. One is just straight and to the point, and then the other one is, while we considered lots of good applicants and we were thoroughly impressed with your application, two paragraphs later, we couldn't find a spot for you or something, you know, some kind of like, that's more for them than it is for you.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to take it.
They don't want to say no.
It's just
you're
going to
take
polite.
It poorly no matter what.
Yeah.
It's just being polite. That's a different, like, it's like they feel better about, you know, mincing out. Oh, you're
having
a great applicant. Yeah.
Reject so many people when a lot of people are deserving.
Yeah, I feel like there is kind of that generic statement like, oh, you know, we regret to inform you that you were not. You know, we have so many qualified applicants and we cannot possibly accept them all. Yeah, you know, and I think like to your point, it is like being polite, but it is also, I think, more for the school to be able to feel okay that they like have to tell you no. Yeah. But the strategy that the match people take, like, you know, I can see the logic because there's kind of no
rip the band-aid.
Yeah,
off.
I mean, there's like, you know, there's what are you gonna say, right? I mean, it's just it's something nobody ever wants to hear, but a lot, you know. People have to. Well,
I think it is true, though, that I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, plus for match, like you get to scramble in the week after and try to apply to other places, and also like you're not getting a rejection from one specific school. It's like from like the you said the residency match board or whatever.
It just tells exactly.
You know, so like an individual school, if you're applying, especially like on a first cycle. They want you to feel like you're wanted, so you'll give them your money to apply again and try again.
That's true.
The algorithm has no feelings.
The algorithm does not care.
It would be nice, though, if they're a little bit more honest to some people and said, like, look, you know, we appreciate that you put this work into your application, but to be honest, you know, you're not going to be successful applying to this medical school for X, Y, and Z reasons. And, you know, because that saves people the investment of like, you know, there are some people who just, you know, don't want to give up on the dream and it's not going to be realistic for them one way or the other without considerable, you know, additional investment. And I think it would save people a lot of trouble if some schools were just a little bit more open about that.
I think in defense of med schools, I do want to say that the statement that, you know, coming to a med school interview is also about figuring out whether you're going to be a good fit for this school is also true.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true. Mm-hmm. It's true, you know, but you can put the question is appropriate, you know, like that's a true statement, and also a completely appropriate and welcome thing to say on interview day, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. You know, guys, relax, have a great interview day. We want, you know, this is just as much about you as it is about us. Mm-hmm. But I feel more like that's the kind of place to say that kind of stuff.
Mm. I have a couple points. One, I'm definitely going to forget one of them, but
point one. Point I'm not really one. Sure this what is that point the one is.
I'm going to remember. So I do think in conversations with members of unnamed admission committee people, I'm not on the admission committee here, so it's not like I'm speaking on a like authoritarian view or anything. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I've heard that interviews really are for red flags. I mean, to a certain extent, you're not going to impress someone on an interview.
They can break you, but they can't make you.
Right. And so, it really is true. Yeah. I mean, you'd have to be incredibly, I mean, it's basically like, are you a sociopath?
Well, now all the people that got rejected after interviews are going to feel like crap.
I mean, but so that's what I'm saying, Justin. Is like, your interview might not have done that to you, though. You know, to a certain extent, you have a lot of qualified applications. And statistically, I think I read this in The Last Lecture, if you ever read that, written by a perfect, it's a really good book. Anyway, as an aside, he was saying like he was waitlisted at certain universities when he was an applicant, and the author that is, and he said statistically there is no difference between people who get accepted, their stats, like educational stats, and those who get waitlisted. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like throwing a dart at a dartboard. And so, you know, does this person get in versus that person? It's kind of just a numbers game. And so your interview, them saying like, this is more about, you know, it's about both of us, it's kind of true in the sense that your interview probably won't do that much for you, honestly. It can hurt you, but it's not going to change.
99% of people, I would venture to guess, have like perfectly adequate interviews. Mm-hmm. And that 1% of people are like, you know, kind of out themselves as, you know, for whatever reason, just not socially compatible with being a doctor,
right?
Mm-hmm. There's that guy who did the movie. The movie theater shooting in Colorado? Oh, who interviewed for grad school at Iowa? And mm-hmm. The legend is anyway that the person who interviewed him was like, absolutely not. You know?
Yeah, he's mentally
something's going on.
Yeah. So I guess I didn't mean to imply. Also, I like to go back. I didn't mean to imply people that get rejected after their interview are sociopaths. I just meant that your interview really isn't like that. You know, I think the interview really is to show you the school, because it's not going to do much for you.
Well, and particularly for outstanding students, I think it's more true. Like, if you have extremely good test scores and extremely good grades and really impressive resume or whatever, you know, and you're probably going to get in somewhere, then that's true that the schools are kind of competing for you. It's like once you get down a little bit more around the borderline scores.
The normal people.
It's a stratified market in that way. Yeah. Though. But it's always always a seller's market.
Yeah. You know, which is not to say that that's like a good or fair way to choose applicants. Yeah. I'm just saying, like,
I think in this case, so this is my personal, you know, I don't have a lot of research to support. I have some research to support this, but this is kind of just my own opinion. I think that in America, we kind of like, we set ourselves up for being disappointed around stuff like this because we believe too much in like merit and a merit-based system, and that if you've earned it, you will get the things that you have worked for. Like, if I work and got this great MCAT score and I work really hard and I get good grades, I'm going to get into every medical school that I want to. But the numbers just don't work out like that. There's too much of a bias towards people who have money and who have privilege. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it is, unfortunately. That's life. That's so pronounced in admissions at all levels of higher education. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't think it's a good thing. I'm not like preaching like, you know, buck up, buttercup, but I think we kind of do set ourselves up for this, and it's unfortunate. It certainly is, but.
Well, you have to acknowledge it to try to change it at all.
Yeah, and I'm not, absolutely.
But Justin, it's a weird game.
It is a weird game.
And a mentor of mine, former Shortcoat podcaster himself, Keenan, would say it's a weird game you only get to learn the rules of after you're done playing. Mm. Yeah. And I'll tell you myself, I got outright rejected the first time I applied to medical school, but I reapplied. I got accepted. I just read you my email. I didn't match on Monday, so I had to do the SOAP process, and I found an excellent position that I'm extremely happy with.
That's good.
And so, you know, if you keep at it, you generally can make something of it. Is it going to be what you had initially planned? I don't know. You know, there are no guarantees in this world.
And I think what this is, what you're saying is that, we cling to this illusion of control. You know, we have, we have control over our lives, and if only we, it's like, you know, in the match process, you have a small amount of control, but just like most of life, you know, things are going to happen that you didn't expect, and you know, you gotta roll with, you gotta be prepared to roll with those things. So you didn't get in, you didn't get the residency program you thought you were going to get, you didn't get the location you thought you were going to get. That's true of everything we do. We just like to pretend that, you know, we have a plan and that things are going to go to that plan. But let's move on. Thank you, Julian, for your question. Appreciate that. We have another question from Justin, who's worried about keeping his intellectual strength up before he comes to medical school.
Hello from San Diego, California. My name is Justin, and I'm currently slated to attend Western University of Health Sciences College of Osteopathic Medicine this fall.
Congratulations.
Until then, I'm just working part-time at a local lab. I have listened to your show for 8 1/2 hours a day for a week or two, and as entertaining as your show is, I'd like to know if any of your cast members have any tips for staying sharp before starting school? I'm currently playing around with the PicMinic app and learning things here and there, but any other helpful apps or tips would be much appreciated. Thanks for keeping me entertained, and take care.
Have we made that many episodes?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
What I love about this question, and thank you, Justin, what I love about this question is, you know, like, as entertaining as you are, would you actually give me some information I can use?
Could you please be helpful for a
change? We understand. What do you guys think? I mean, so he's about to be in medical school. He wants to stay sharp. He wants to stay sharp.
Dave,
you know?
No, I'm saying take a break. Don't stay sharp.
Dave put this on the Facebook page, and like 10 people commented, just take a break. Just stop. Just sleep all you can.
Yeah.
I don't know, because they're going to teach you what they want to teach you in the way they want to teach it to you. It's just, I feel like it would be better just to maybe pick up a hobby. Actually, this is my advice. Pick up a hobby that you can do in spare time that doesn't take a lot of time. You know, like start learning how to play the guitar or something, so that, you know, when you get home from a long day, you can pick up the guitar for a half an hour. Because that is going to be so much better for you and your mental health than learning one more fact about Staph aureus or whatever.
Yeah.
I would say work on yourself as a person outside of medicine or anything to do with medicine. Like learn how to cook.
Yeah.
Figure out an exercise regime that works well for you that you can stick to while you're in school, get in better shape. Like, I mean, if you want to, I think one thing that you could do is read like books about different topics in medicine. I mean, like I'm reading the book now, The Emperor of All Maladies, which is super cool. And like, I think doing stuff like that can kind of help give you a framework of what you're trying to achieve as a medical student, like outside of the curriculum. Like, you know, obviously you want to get good grades and everything like that, but you know, you don't really need to get a head start on that. Like what you really should get a head start on is like figuring out what your interests are broadly as they relate to like medicine and healthcare, and working on like yourself as an individual who can subsist outside of medical school and medicine.
So. Yeah. Cause the fact of the matter is you're going to get not a ton of time to think about those ideas when you're in medical school. So,
and honestly, you're not really going to get that far ahead, like trying to jump on the curriculum now, you know, like,
PicMonic is great, though. Just saying, it helped get me through step one. So, shout out to PicMonic. But, well, like,
they
don't
are
break
not
yourself
an
with it right now.
Official sponsor of the Short Coat Podcast
yet.
It could be. Call me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the idea. I like that. It's really good advice.
Yeah, for sure.
Get a start on figuring out who you are. And
I especially
where you
like,
want to be.
Like travel some. And,
I was going to say travel.
Sure. Yeah. While you still can. And like you said, read about public health and global health and sort of get an idea of what kind of issues are facing your patients and what kind of things you can do to really improve their lot in life. Because at least I think that being a sort of public servant is a big part of what a doctor should be. So this would be a good time to explore what areas you're passionate about.
Read up on like the healthcare laws in the country and how they're affecting patient care.
Someone save us, please.
It's an important thing to learn about, though, you know, something that you don't get too much in actual instruction on.
And I was talking to some doctors the other day at like a meet and greet thing or whatever. And
fancy.
I know. And, you know, we asked like, what's something that you didn't really expect about practice or like something that you don't learn about as much in med school? And I mean, they were like the bureaucracy basically that's going to get in your way of treating patients how you want to treat them. And a lot of that has to do with cost, with insurance, with healthcare laws, with tons of paperwork. So, I mean, if that's something you're interested in helping improve, that would be great.
I like the travel idea because I like all of these ideas as to what to do over the summer, because you've got what, 1 or 2 summers left.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For the love of God, depending. Do not lock yourself in the library for like the second to last one.
Yeah, 1 or 2 summers left before you're like going to be expected to do this for the rest of your life. And then from now on, you're going to have maybe a week of vacation.
Yeah.
If you're lucky, you know, you're going to have a week at a time where you can get away. So
stock up on vitamin D.
B12. Don't waste it.
We're making a hard sell. You can tell.
Yeah.
Well, it's too late. He's already in.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Listen to us or don't.
Well, I mean, you haven't paid all your tuition yet.
That's true. It's not too late. You could change your mind.
Have the loan started accruing interest?
That's a real question. Hey, I have a friend who's a manager at a grocery store and makes a 6-figure salary.
What?
So
that's
he
not fair.
He gets to go home. You know, he works no more than 40 hours a week.
You do it because you love it.
Yeah.
Well, good luck, Justin. Let us know how it goes. You know, maybe call us with a what I did this summer comment.
Yeah. Send us pictures.
Yeah.
Of you doing all the fun things you're going to do this summer.
It's really going to be awesome when he sends us pictures of just like him with Picmonic
at the Grand Canyon,
like in various different positions in a library, or even better, yeah, like at the Grand Canyon, but like completely ignoring the view and just
sitting
like,
in the car,
or like just do a tour of libraries, like the Great Libraries of America.
Oh yeah,
yeah, like
that's
DC.
Not a bad idea.
That'd be Library of Congress with Picmonic.
The Seattle Public Library is pretty cool.
It's so cool.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is it so cool?
It's like a pyramid and you can go to the top and look out. It's really cool.
Like an upside down pyramid, but like weird shaped, and it's all glass.
It's all glass.
And all windows. Oh. Like it's crazy.
Highly
looking.
Recommend.
Yeah.
Well, good. Are you guys excited about the president's first budget request to Congress?
Nope.
That would be one word that you could.
Dave, what kind of question is that? No. Next question.
Even if the budget was good, would we be excited about it? Like,
I'm just saying that.
I would be thrilled if the budget was good, actually, because I would be pleasantly surprised.
Well, you know,
if it was good, I would be suspicious of what it's hiding.
Yeah.
Oh my God! Right.
He would like to cut the 2018 budget of the National Institutes of Health by $6 billion. That's nearly 20%. If you're not familiar with the National Institutes of Health, you might want to crawl out under that rock. it is the prestigious research institute funded by the U.S. government that basically contributes a lot of money to biomedical research and thus curing the world.
It's like what percentage of research would you say is funded by the NIH?
We could probably look it up.
Somebody look that up. I don't know the answer.
It's not going to be an easy question to answer, because the thing is, there's the traditional role of the NIH was to do basic science funding, right? Mm-hmm. To find out like, ooh, how does this system work? And since everyone, like even the sort of businessification of the NIH has turned everyone to saying, you know, we want translational research. It's got to be, you know, it's got to be translational. It's right, like, that's actually, that's probably like the people who stand to make $50 billion off the drug. That should probably be their responsibility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the federal money should be going out to like fundamentally figuring out how these things work. What are the proteins involved or whatever, you know, because there's a lot of stuff. We've talked about this on the show before where like you just can't predict what, you know, utility there will be to, you know, some green jellyfish fluorescent protein. Like,
right.
Yeah.
Some right. bacterial well, immune system. It turns out to be CRISPR, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I found that Wikipedia says that the NIH controls more than 50% of all funding for health research and 85% of all funding for health studies in universities.
Yeah.
So
it's a lot.
That's
I remember in the 2008 like economy crashed or whatever, the NIH I think went from funding like the top 12% of all grants to like 10%. So they cut out 2% of grant funding from the budget, and it was like, I mean, that's a huge. I
remember it being like a disaster. Yeah, it felt like a disaster. Yeah.
Well, right, and when you think about it, that 2% is almost a 20% decrease.
Mm.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, in funding.
Right.
2% in the terms 2% of 12% is 1/6, right?
Right. So the number of projects getting funded went down by 20-ish percent.
Just blew my mind math-wise. Thanks.
You know, it's interesting too to me that so I'm not going to like try to partisanize this, but you know, we in America like to do things like ice bucket challenges and all that other garbage. But and I'm not, you know, trying to say that you shouldn't do that ice bucket challenge, but if you're
because
willing
by
to,
garbage she means that in the nicest possible way,
silly things. But if you're willing to stand outside and dump a bucket of ice water on your if you care enough about medical research to do something like that, you should also care enough to look into this see in the people who you're voting for, your senators, your representatives, and see how do you stand for funding on these types of things? Because that's really what gets, you know, is going to do the most good. So if you want to have funding for ALS research, you need to make sure that your representatives are held accountable to funding organizations like this.
Yeah, if you're going to raise awareness, then you better be aware, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And one might say otherwise, you're just contributing drops in a bucket.
Yeah. You can't, it's not
an
enough.
Ice
to just,
cold bucket.
Oh, yeah. It's not enough to just be aware. Awareness is step one. It's important and it's necessary, but it's not going to make change. The thing that's going to make change is who you vote for, who, like, people, like what kind of laws get put into place, what kind of, you know, public service activities, like, you personally are doing, going out and, like, helping people or campaigning for things. That's when it's going to ultimately make the difference, not just being aware that it exists and being sad about it.
Yeah, it's like one of the things that really bothers me about the whole kind of like breast cancer industrial complex. You know, like I don't need to see how many more times does the NFL need to like put their players in pink equipment for people to know about breast cancer and realize that like breast cancer is a terrible disease and we should do something about it, right? Like no. We got it, like, right?
Yeah.
But how many people know, like, what the Dana-Farber Institute is, you know? How many people know, like, what their, like you were saying, what their representative's stance on funding the NIH is? Like, there's this sort of, like, veneer of superficiality around these things that people can tell themselves that they're a good person and that they're doing, you know, all of the right things.
Yeah.
But it's just that a lot of times it's this kind of veneer.
It's kind of a form of political correctness.
It is,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly guilty of it too. Like, there's things that I say that I care about that I clearly am not doing as much as I could. But
yeah. Well,
I mean, we all have those things.
Yeah.
You can't break yourself over everything every single day. You know, you got to pick your hill to die on. But, so
I guess it's like the NFL spends so much money on this, and they're a multi-billion-dollar company. Like, they could afford to put their money where their mouth is.
To sponsor some research,
yeah,
straight up.
It's clearly, and you know, like, especially with things like head injuries, which they're such a huge cultural force that has caused so much, like, human tragedy in that realm, and they do
resisting that research.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know. It's really frustrating.
What I like about the article I read was the quote from the director of White House Office of Management and Budget. This is an America First budget. We went through his speeches and we turned those policies into numbers. That must have been quite a challenge. Given.
They don't even make sense as words. Given, no wonder they don't make sense as numbers.
Think they must not have read the speech where he said that Mexico is going to pay for the wall.
Right.
Yeah. I guess that's not happening anymore. So.
I was listening to a different podcast on, and they were talking about the budget, and they said this funding of NIH goes directly against Trump's promise to, quote, end all disease, unquote.
Well, he was going to end all this.
He's not going to do that anymore?
Yeah, he's not going to do it anymore.
I've been lied to.
There's how many diseases?
Going in the opposite direction.
I don't remember that pledge.
He doesn't either.
He doesn't like diseases.
Also on the block, and these are for complete elimination.
Oh, God.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the National Endowment for the Humanities, and quite a few other programs that are less familiar to me, but these are among the ones. This is why...
Meals on Wheels. God save Meals on Wheels.
Is that a complete elimination one?
I think they wanted to.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
It's a huge program. It feeds after-school funding programs.
Mm-hmm. So I read that if you took all of the money that Donald Trump spends on his trips to Mar-a-Lago and things like that, you could pay for Meals on Wheels for a year with like one of his trips.
Yeah.
What about the amount of money we spend to put Melania up in Trump Tower in New York City?
Oh my God, right?
Such a false equivalency always made to about like, well, you know, we didn't complain when Obama was president. Well, number one, you did. And number two,
oh my God, right?
And number two, it's a completely false equivalency. Like, yeah. Donald Trump himself was the one who was like, oh, he's golfing all the time. This is terrible.
It's not true.
And now he's golfing all the time.
George W. Bush golfed more than President Obama, and I'm sure Donald Trump is on par to...
Oh, on par. You know,
to do more.
Even Bush in his like famously politically silent state has had some words about Trump's performance.
Never thought I would miss the guy.
George W. Bush is so goddamn cute now.
Yeah, he is
adorable.
He's the cutest little war criminal.
Yeah. I'm glad that you said that, because I've been thinking that, like, oh man.
I just think old people are cute. I can't help it.
Well,
and he paints.
I do love his relationship with Michelle and Obama. I just love that they're besties. It's just great. I thought about it. I like never thought I'd like want Mitt Romney to be president. Like never thought that would seem like a good idea.
So what can we do? Like, positively speaking, is there anything we can do?
Well, I'm pretty sure
do people have ideas?
Here's the thing. From what I've heard, the pundits, and you know, pundits are what they are. But from what I heard, I mean, this budget I don't think is going to get passed.
Hopefully. No, I mean, budgets are aspirational.
Yeah.
Which is saying something. Yeah. But
which would mean the healthcare changes also wouldn't pass.
I mean, but again, I mean, this is what they're, you know, coming to the table with, that's a little terrifying.
I think what probably happened, you know, is that Trump has no idea what is in the budget. And his little, you know, basically his colleagues wrote it, and these are the people who are, you know, extreme free market capitalists who would
Steve
be
Steve Bannon. Right. Wrote it. Mike Pence wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Jared Kushner wrote it.
Yeah.
Donald Trump has no idea.
He has no idea. If it wasn't on Fox News first, he doesn't know.
Exactly.
So John tried to move on, but didn't work.
Sorry.
Very
well.
Sorry,
it's hard.
I was trying to be positive.
It's all right. You were trying to be positive.
Casey's doing a great job over here, and we're just me. I'm just like.
You guys are all aware that the cap on resident working hours of 16.
You are trying real hard to bring me down today, aren't you?
Got basically
look
increased.
Look into your future, John. Look into your future.
Increased back to 24 hours now. There's been a lot of debate over the cap and the number of hours that residents work. Some feel it's safer for patients as well as doctors to work fewer hours because it means that... residents are less fatigued and that they make less errors. Others worry that increasing the number of handoffs between doctors increases mistakes, and that limiting the number of hours limits the amount of training doctors receive. So now the cap is changing to 24 hours. That's the headline.
This is just for interns also. It was already 24 right. hours. 28 hours, actually. I think you get 4 hours for just like charting at the end. So it was already the case for them, but this is for first year.
But this is just, this is the headline. I thought the other interesting bits that I didn't really realize at first was that there are now requirements for supervisors to more closely monitor their residents and their well-being, whatever that means.
Window dressing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And some of the old rules have been retained. You're not allowed to work more than 80 hours in, on average.
That's nice.
In a week. You're not allowed to document that you've worked more than 80 hours.
Exactly. Yeah.
So
you've got to have one day off every 7 days. You can't work overnights more than once every 3 nights. Is especially relevant to you, John.
It's an age. It's an age-old battle between labor and the powers that be.
Well, some people wanted to. Some
preach.
Some medical students and residents wanted to work longer hours.
That's
remember bringing
they
this
have
up on the
Stockholm
show.
Stockholm syndrome.
Well,
they
I remember, but I remember bringing this up on the show in 2011 when that cap. God, my voice is getting worse and worse. When that cap first was. Put into place. And I remember people saying, you know, oh, but that'll limit how long we can work. That's terrible. And I was like, what?
You've already been brainwashed, yeah.
I mean, if you really want to work that bad, take up, like, go work at some free clinic somewhere or, like,
or just
a research paper.
Or don't leave.
You can moonlight and get paid for it.
Yeah. There's also, you know, there's an argument like more handoffs and more patient errors. Do better handoffs. There you go. Like, I solved your problem.
Yeah,
do better handoffs.
It is kind of a canard, I think, that's the justification given for why it's better to work longer hours. Like, you're not really addressing the problem. If the handoffs are the problem, then address the problem. Right.
You know what the worst handoff is? When you have to give someone else. So or you have to give someone else your colleague's patients because they killed themselves because the culture in medicine is so toxic.
Yeah.
That's the worst handoff. You know, that's what we should be trying to avoid.
Yeah, and actually, again, this is another one of those sort of false dichotomies. You know how you solve the problem of having overworked residents? You add more residents.
Mm-hmm.
So they work fewer hours.
Oh, and coincidentally, you solve the shortage of doctors in the future, too.
Yeah.
You
know? So,
and the shortage of residents.
And to do that requires a commitment, and not to take this too politically, but requires a commitment from politicians to say, we're going to fund this.
Yeah.
We're going to fund the training of residents. We're going to fund the training of having more of these spots so that we don't have to have, you know, the neurosurgery team has something called extended duty hours. I don't even know what that is. I think it's 100.
Mm. Neurosurgery works.
It's it's unbelievable.
However
right?
much unreasonable like, people work, they work more.
Well, and I mean, I think there also is another argument people use is that if you don't work these hours, people aren't trained. You know,
enough.
I mean, it is true that the more you're at the hospital, the more you see, et cetera, but I mean, first of all, I don't think you can really say what is the right amount of, you know, why is working 100 hours better than working 80 hours for learning? I don't know.
At some point, there must be a diminishing
margin. Right. There has to be. Right. And there's no research on that. So
it's really interesting to talk to senior physicians who've sort of been through the whole thing. You know, they did the residencies. And again, you know, everyone has their own biases, but I've not met anyone. I guess I have heard one person who said they were concerned about the quality of training that the physicians were getting because of hour limits. And surprise, surprise, they were a neurosurgeon. But everyone else that I'd talked to, and by now it's actually dozens of, you know, faculty in private practice and academic centers saying, you know, I don't think that their training is any inferior. It's different in a certain sense. For example, because of the way bureaucracy has changed, and this is something as a med student I've seen, the roles have changed a lot. Mm-hmm. Like if you ask someone like who was in my mom's generation, she told me, you know, in deliveries, she'd intubated hundreds of newborns. You know, to remove meconium from their airway. Mm.
And what position was she in?
As a resident.
Okay.
And now, like, I think I had met some third year residents who'd like not intubated a neonate at all. And so, like, will you be prepared to, you know, so to a certain extent, we're seeing fellows doing things residents used to do. Residents doing things nurses and medical students used to do.
Yeah.
And medical students sitting on their hands. And then getting yelled at if they are caught doing that, or if for some reason they go do something else.
That's productive. So true.
A game you don't get to know the rules of until you're done playing.
It does strike me as like this kind of the same type of thing, though, where if you're making an argument that residents aren't getting adequate training, then address that problem, right? And make internal medicine residency a year longer or something like that. Like, if mm-hmm. that, like, that may not be what people want to hear, but it's a false dichotomy to say that these are the problems we see in residency and we have only one tool to fix them, which is how much residents work in a week. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. Yeah, you know?
And it's because I think the secret is that it's not about either of those things. And it's really about labor. It's about money. It's about residents to make money.
Residents are the cheap labor of the American medical system. Yeah. And without them, the system wouldn't run.
I mean, and this puts us at odds because I think that, you know, that voting population is saying, well, we don't want to pay for stuff, but the voting population aren't these residents. They're not the, you know, they're not the baby, but the residents aren't baby boomers. But that vast majority of the populace that's being affected indirectly by these changes, but affected directly by taxes and spending.
Oh, and also standing up for your own rights isn't being lazy. Thanks, baby boomers. Yeah. Not all baby boomers, hashtag. But, you know, the people that say that, like, standing up for your rights and asking for better, demanding better than your parents or your grandparents had, I feel like that's a good thing.
It's
not a weak thing.
You know, I'm always astounded at, I hope this doesn't come off the wrong way too, though. I know, right?
You're spicy today.
I'm very spicy. I don't know why.
No, I like
She's at the taco bar.
I don't follow the golden rule of the internet, and I always read the comments. Aww. And I know it's terrible. But so I'm always astounded at how quickly people can dehumanize doctors. Yes. In the sense of, like, and I'm not like trying to be like, we're the victim, you know, that kind of thing. And like, but so people say, you know, residents should work less because it hurts their patients. And that's true. I agree that, you know, a tired resident is not as capable of taking care of their patients as a fully alert and awake resident. But also, in addition to that, a resident should not work that much because they're a human being, you know, who has a life, and they deserve rest in their life. Mm-hmm. They deserve to have a life outside of work. And people forget that, you know, we're not like workhorses for other people. And it's a little sad to me when I read about that, because as far as I know, I didn't stop being a person when I went to med school.
Well, you missed the memo.
So you bring up something really interesting. And I think that, you know, that is identity and job identity is so absolutely crucial to this sort of American dream.
Yeah.
That people definitely get the, you know, that sort of transitive property, they drop the human out.
Well, and it's especially true in medicine. You know, doctor as an identity has been a thing for a very long time, and some of that's because you had to. Some of that's because if you were a family physician in a small town 100 years ago, you were it. You were on call 24/7. That's still true for a lot of family physicians in small towns, you know, but it doesn't have to be true for everybody, and like, you can self-select into that now. Like, you shouldn't have to do it just because somebody had to do it before you,
right? Well, or because someone says you're lazy if you don't,
yeah,
or because they said I did it when I was your age or whatever.
Well, and also, since I mean, we've been talking about false dichotomies of all these, like, you know, these arguments, is I think one false dichotomy that this, you know, argument is built on, that, you know, a doctor should be, you know, self-sacrificial to their patients, et cetera, is built on the false dichotomy that in order to provide good patient care, you must completely sacrifice who you are as a person. But I think, like, the opposite is actually true, in the sense of, like, a doctor who takes care of themselves as a person is better able to empathize. You know, someone who draws boundaries is better able to take care of the person when, you know, you're in need, for instance. Like, I think, and there's research actually to that effect.
Yeah, and you can still make some sacrifices. You make a lot of sacrifices, right, that are necessary in medicine. It's just it doesn't have to be your whole self.
You can't disappear into the profession.
Yeah,
you can't. You have to have a person who you're, like we were saying to this guy who's, you know, looking to go to medical school in the fall. You can't disappear into being a medical student or being a doctor. You have to have an identity.
Yeah, there's maybe 10 people in the world that actually enjoy that, and you know, all more power to them. But they're not most of us.
And it shouldn't be the expectation.
Yeah, it shouldn't be the expectation.
But it's hard too, because doctors are not a very they're not a very sympathetic class of profession. You know, like. Yeah.
Like, oh, poor doctors.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody's like, oh, you know, boy, they really have it rough. And, you know, that's fair. Like, but like you said, you can't expect people to not be human beings because of the type of job they do. I think it kind of reminds me of the junior doctor strike, like the UK, basically, like their residents are junior doctors. So they went on strike a few months ago or a year ago or something like that. It's kind of an ongoing struggle, I think, with the national health system in the UK.
That's so hard to do too, because then like you're not as much of a jerk if you go on strike and like washing machines don't get made for a couple weeks.
Right. Well, like, it's like how police aren't allowed to go on strike.
Yeah.
You know,
they're
integral to the functioning of society, just in the same way that, you know, that the medical system is.
Yeah.
But it's also a group of people who like need to be acknowledged as humans as well. You know?
Well, and also good argument for labor protection for them in that case as well, right? Like, this tells us that we should treat people in those classes of labor especially.
Yeah.
Because like, it's very easy for someone to leverage that against you. Like, how dare you let these people die, you know, because you want your wages to be taken more seriously, or you want your hours to be, you know, so it's much easier to be leveraged against you if you're a firefighter and you want to strike, or, you know, a nurse and you want to strike than it is, you know, like you said, if you're working at an auto plant or something like that.
Which is not to say that those people also deserve to be treated fairly. Right. And that's why we should have collective bargaining, Iowa. And like, that's why we need labor protections. But
in my career, over the years of time that I will have my career, like, one of the things I think is important to change about medicine as a profession is I think that there needs to be more emphasis on physicians as an organized lobbying group, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, they're I think traditionally physicians have kind of resisted the idea of being, you know, of organizing their labor, because they kind of have this idea that they're like above that, and like, you know, we're not just
becoming politically active.
Yeah, we're not just employees, you know, we are, you know, separate from that or distinct from that. But if the medical system is going to become more corporatized and more treat physicians more like they're employees rather than, you know, partners or the people running the enterprise, then I think it's only to physicians' benefit to, you know, band together to have their voice heard, because frankly, that's kind of the only way that it's going to happen in the system.
Well, the AMA, though, the American Medical
AMA
Association,
has really been, don't get me started on the AMA.
Okay. So
it's like that's tough. And it's tough too, because like,
I don't know much about it.
To agree on something for one thing. But
I mean, I don't know much about their power as a lobbying organization. So you're saying that it's not,
they have huge power as a lobbying organization, but not, many doctors are not part of the AMA, don't have a voice in the AMA, and it doesn't represent the views accurately of a lot of doctors. They do plenty of good stuff too, as far as I can tell, but and you probably know more about it because you seem to have opinions.
Well,
but
other professional healthcare organizations like the ANA, the American Nursing Association, I believe it's called, and some of the professional organizations that lobby for like nurse practitioners and things like that, and CRNAs have been really pushing hard to expand the scope of practice and expand independence of those types of practitioners. And I think there are a lot of physicians who are against that, on the principle that that's if you want to practice independent of a physician, then that means you're essentially practicing medicine. And the AMA has done very little to kind of to counteract that and to bring that voice of physicians to that discussion. So,
well,
I think it's not a perfect organization.
I've been kind of thinking this for a while now that one of the things that maybe physicians and scientists in general need to do is to become a lot more active in the public discourse. And to put themselves out there and you know, enter the world of politics and things like that. In fact, I feel like I read something and I wish I had taken note of it more, but I feel like there is an organization of scientists right now that's trying to put forward scientists as potential members of Congress and things like that in a more organized way, which is might be a good thing. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, because otherwise you're just sort of competing in the noise machine.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that really, like...
I mean, we can podcast the shit out of this, but...
Right. Because
we need are people who are being politically active.
You know, it's not really clear what the best answer for patients is, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, in the state of Iowa, you know, the Iowa Medical Society fights tooth and nail to restrict access of any other providers, nurse practitioners, PAs, PhDs, to provide anything more than they do.
Yeah. And,
but if you think about it, how many of our classmates are moving to rural Iowa to become a psychiatrist?
Not enough.
Right. And so what's ultimately good for patients is completely at odds with what's good for this, you know, physician lobbying group, which I can see creating tension in the lobbying group. But I care more about the outcomes for patients than I do about the, you know, artificially high salary presented by, you know, some rent keepers.
Yeah. And, you know, the argument would be, oh, they're not capable of taking care of those patients or whatever. But as someone who's like fairly active in the Iowa Medical Society, like that in particular is an issue that I like don't agree with them on, that I think psychologists should be considered for prescribing privileges under certain circumstances and with certain training. And that's really hard, you know, being sort of somewhat active in an organization and not agreeing with all their policies. It's a lot of internal tension for one thing, but then also like you don't know how much you can advocate for as a student. And like when it was interesting, I went to a lobbying day with them actually yesterday, 2 days ago, at the Capitol. And like most of the stuff this time I agreed with, but there were lots of other, you know, there were lots of people that went with IMS with their white coats and everything to advocate for other bills that like we weren't talking about at all that were arguably more important. There was a fail first campaign. So you have to fail a drug before you can try another drug that might be more expensive for a lot of diseases. But that tends to be based more on price than on what is like evidence-based, what makes the most sense. We weren't talking about that at all. We were just talking about tort reform, which, you know, also important because medical malpractice like is kind of ridiculous. The fees for that are really high in insurance, but it's a different issue. But it was just so strange to me that there were all these other issues that were like very relevant to patients that we didn't really talk about. And people had to find stuff on their own and come knowing that that's what they wanted to talk to their legislators about.
Pick your battles though, too. There's so many, true. Seems like lately there's so many battles to fight.
True.
So, well, I'm calling this one done because my voice is just about ready to crap out. That's our show. Thank you, Corbin, Casey, John, and Matt for being my co-hosts this week.
Hey, wait.
Let's give yourselves a round of applause. Oh, that was so heartfelt.
We should put in a plug. Dave. We should put in a plug for the other podcast.
Oh.
We were talking about how doctors are not gods nor machines.
Not gods or machines. That should be coming out at some point in the future. Jason's doing that. Casey participated in at least one of them. So, yeah, listen for that.
It's about medicine and the humanities.
Medicine and the humanities. Arts, writing, things like that.
Mm.
Yep. And thank you, listeners, for making us a part of your week. If you like what you heard today, consider sharing us with your colleagues. If you have a suggestion for something you'd like to talk about, send it to theshortcoats@gmail.com or leave us a message at 347-SHORT-CT and like our Facebook page, where we often do shows on Facebook Live like we did today, so you can join us in making the world of medical school a better place. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox and our closing music is by Arco Fox. Talk to you in 1 week.